ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, or you're concerned about your health, stick around for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Michael Weberman, who's the executive director of the Farm Animal Rights Movement. That's coming up a little later on the show. First, some news.
Wildlife Extra reports that a staggering one quarter of the world's sharks and rays are threatened with extinction, and this is according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and rays are particularly at risk. The study is a result of a collaboration of 302 experts from 64 countries and the IUCN Shark Specialist Group. They analyzed the conservation status of over 1,000 shark, ray, and closely related species. Their analysis showed that sharks and their relatives are facing an alarmingly elevated risk of extinction. In the greatest perils are those species that live in shallow water and therefore are accessible to fisheries. Overfishing is the main threat to the species, according to the analysis. Reported catches of sharks and rays peaked in 2003 and have been dominated by rays for the last 40 years. Actual catches are likely to be grossly underreported. Unintentionally caught sharks and rays account for much of the catch, yet developing markets and depleting fishery targets have made this bycatch increasingly welcome. Intentional killing of sharks and rays due to the perceived risks that they pose to people, fishing gear, or target species is contributing to the threatened status of at least 12 species. A surprising finding is that the rays, including sawfish, guitarfish, stingrays, and wedgefish, are generally worse off than sharks, with 5 out of the 7 most threatened families made up of rays. And while public media and government attention to the plight of sharks is growing, the widespread depletion of rays is largely unnoticed. Conservation action for rays is lagging far behind, which only heightens concerns for this species group.
After being successfully passed by the U.S. House and Senate, President Obama has signed the Farm Bill into law. Thankfully, the controversial King Amendment was taken out of the bill. Representative Steve King, a Republican from Iowa, had attached an amendment which would have had disastrous consequences for animal welfare. It would have prohibited states from enacting any laws that set standards for agricultural production that exceeded those in other states governing the same production. If it had stayed in the Farm Bill, the King Amendment would have struck down California's Prop 9, which bans extreme confinement cages for egg-laying hens. It would have also struck down bans on confinement crates for pigs and veal calves. It would have nullified state laws in Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Maine, Michigan, Ohio, Oregon, Washington, and Rhode Island dealing with intensive confinement of farmed animals. Also, it would have nullified Maryland's ban on arsenic in poultry feed. It would have removed bans on horse slaughter in several states, and it would have also undone laws on the sale of dogs and cats as food. It would have struck down state laws requiring labeling of farm-raised fish. It would have nullified California's prohibition on the sale of foie gras made by force-feeding ducks and geese, a law that's already been challenged in court and found to be constitutional. The King Amendment would have invalidated hundreds of state laws on animal protection, food safety, and even labor welfare. Steve King, a Republican from Iowa, our country's largest egg-producing state, had attached this amendment to punish California for its more humane treatment of chickens. But the amendment was overly broad, infringed on states' rights, and was severely misguided. And we're glad it was dropped from the Farm Bill. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Michael Weberman. He holds a degree in environmental economics and policy and is executive director of FARM, the Farm Animal Rights Movement. And he coordinates many of the campaigns of FARM. We'll be talking with Michael next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Michael Weberman. Thanks for being with us on the show, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hi, Michael. Can you start out by telling our listeners a little bit about how you got into animal issues?
Sure, of course. So I guess like most people, you know, I grew up with an affection for animals. I, you know, had two cats and a dog growing up who I was very bonded to, but I also never really thought about, you know, advocating for animals necessarily, and certainly never thought about the animals that we eat. You know, in fact, I never even thought about the fact that we eat animals. And one day when I was 14 in my French class in high school, we were learning how to say the names of farmed animals in French, and we were learning how to say the sounds that they make in French. So, for instance, like a pig will go groin groin instead of oink in French. I don't know why groin groin sticks out for me, but I really liked that. And then the same day, we learned how to say their cuts of meat in French. And I had just never, I mean, obviously I was 14, I knew animals, I knew meat came from animals, I wasn't that much of a city boy, but like I didn't really ever think about it. I had never really put together the idea, I had never thought about animals and meat really in the same sentence before, if that makes sense. And so I just blurted out some comment. I said, you know, oh, so what are the euphemisms for people meat? And I got sent to the counselor's office.
Oh, no.
And they put me on some kind of, like, you know, freak watch, suicide watch kind of thing.
And cannibalism watch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I went to a religious high school, and I was already kind of the weird punk kid. So when I said that, I think they were like, okay, what's this guy's deal? And anyway, yeah, I was just laying in bed that night, and, you know, it just kind of hit me. I said, okay, well, I was joking about the people-eating thing, but I wasn't joking about being really viscerally bothered by the thought of it, you know? So I basically just went vegetarian on a whim. You know, I had never met a vegetarian to my knowledge, and I'm sure I had, but I had never talked with anyone about it or anything like that. I had never heard of factory farming or anything like that. I just decided I didn't want to eat animals anymore. And then once, you know, I got some books and whatnot on the issues, you know, to help me be a healthy vegetarian, that's where I also learned about the issues with dairy and eggs, and that's how I transitioned to veganism. And as I was getting into environmental activism around the same time, it just kind of made sense to, you know, to move into vegan advocacy, you know, while I was at it.
Too bad it doesn't make sense to a lot of other environmental advocates.
Yeah. I know. That's actually one of the things. I mean, I had planned on becoming an environmental, well, I was an environmental policy major, and I had planned on getting into, you know, global warming fighting activism after college, not on getting into vegan advocacy. And I was, when I moved to D.C., I was working part-time at the organization I work with now, Farm Animal Rights Movement, and also part-time at an environmental organization. And I think there was only one other vegan there and, like, maybe one other vegetarian. And I just was so frustrated and baffled that I had to explain my vegan diet to them. I mean, it's one thing if they weren't vegan but they understood it, but the fact that it was, like, foreign to them and that they weren't that open to it or weren't that receptive to it, you know, was really frustrating for me.
I'm reading Veganomics right now by Nick Cooney, and he says that even vegetarians view vegans as being extreme, and perhaps as advocates we should discard the vegan kind of word and go for something else.
I don't know. What do you think, Michael? I don't think it's a good idea. It's just catching fire, in my opinion.
Veganism?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly, you know, a time and a place for using different terms. I mean, I, in general, you know, Farm is a fan of the word veganism. And the main thing for me is that I really really vehemently oppose the word go, so go vegan or go vegetarian.
Yeah.
I think that's a really really unfriendly term, and people don't think of it that way because they don't mean it to be unfriendly, obviously. But I think for me, the verb that you use to me is a lot more than the vegetarian or vegan debate. So for me, I'm a lot more inclined to make sure I'm using a word like shift towards a vegan diet or something like that. I think the two things that get people are the ism and the go. So if you say go vegan or try veganism, I think that sounds extreme and maybe a little bit culty to people. I've never found any problem saying move towards a vegan diet or shift towards a vegan diet or give a vegan diet a try. Things like that I've never found to be off-putting. And in fact, you know, we have a lot of success getting people to agree to, you know, go vegan, or I just did it myself, oops, to try a vegan diet at least a couple days a week with our 10 Billion Lives tour. So, yeah, I don't think the word vegan is the problem. I think it's the isms and the goes and the other words that make it sound like a doctrine.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's true. Let's talk, you mentioned the 10 Billion Lives tour. Tell us a little bit more about how that works.
Yeah, well, we didn't invent the idea, although I like to think that maybe we kind of perfected it. But, you know, there was an idea that came out about 4 years ago from a small grassroots organization in the Washington, D.C. area called Compassion for Animals, where they said, you know, what would happen if we went to a tabling event and just paid everyone $1 each to watch a four-minute video on, you know, factory farming abuses? And I'll be honest, when I first heard of the idea, I thought that was really stupid. I was like, that's a really weird idea. Why are we going to wait? You know, we don't have a lot of money. Why are we going to give our money to the people eating the meat? That just doesn't make any sense to me. And what happened, though, was they were getting a lot of numbers. You know, they were getting a lot of viewers at these events. And one of our – a foundation that, you know, that funds a lot of our work said that they really wanted us to explore more ways to show videos to people. That was the big thing they wanted us to do in 2011, was show the graphic videos. And so, you know, we just said, well, there's this idea. We're not really sure how we feel about it yet, but where you pay someone $1 to watch a video, and if you were willing to, you know, to help us fund that, we would give it a try because it's not our money, it's your money, basically. And the foundation said, yeah, we actually love the idea. We really want to do this. And so we did a couple test events, and I swear, it took all of 2 minutes for me to completely change my viewpoint on it. I mean, I went from being really skeptical, and I did the event, and literally within the first couple of viewers, I felt completely, I mean, halfway through the first viewer's first viewing, I was completely sold. And the reason is because of the way that their body language and that their faces interacted with the material in a way that I had never seen when we were just showing videos on tabletops in a more, like, there's a big difference between you showing laptops facing outward and people walking by and kind of being confused and jarred by, you know, why is this graphic stuff on there?
Yeah.
And their body language is very closed off, their face is scowling, and they usually walk away after 30 or 45 seconds. They rarely ask questions. They would rarely say, what's this? Why are you showing this? How can I stop this? Anything like that. They would just get disgusted and walk away.
Yeah.
And what we found is the simple incentive of $1, just the motivation to get them to watch the whole thing. You know, it takes a few minutes of letting it sink in before your compassion really hits. You know, your first reaction is the disgust reaction. And you've got to get past that disgust reaction and move into the, you know, the kind of more, how can I stop this reaction? And it takes a few minutes for that. And so, you know, we found that these dollars are a very small price to pay to get people to actually engage with the material. And so when we were trying to think of how we take that larger, you know, beyond just the, you know, Washington, D.C. area where our office is based, we started working with some grassroots activists, and then we built these, like, carts, basically, with the TV screens built into the cart so we could wheel them onto college campuses and festivals. And that was working pretty well. And that's when we said, what if we just built it into a truck? What if we just made a truck with 8 screens and just drove this truck right into festivals, basically, and concerts? And so that's what the 10 Billion Lives Tour is.
Wow.
Is we have a truck outfitted with 8 touchscreens, 4 pairs of headphones per screen, so we can fit up to 32 people at once. And we just go to college campuses and huge, you know, rock concerts and festivals and, you know, get hundreds of viewers a day to watch this material.
What a method of outreach. I'm really glad that's happening.
Yeah. And again, it was something, it's just funny because I was so skeptical of it at first. I mean, I never would have guessed that within 3 years it would completely change the way that we operate. I mean, not really within 3 years. I mean, it's now been 3 years, but I would say within a year and a half it had already completely changed the way we operated. And I just never would have guessed that this outreach method that I was kind of scoffing at when I first heard about it would just a couple years later be our flagship program, basically. So,
do a lot of the people actually take the dollar, or it seems like after watching something like that, you really wouldn't even want the dollar because you'd be thinking of so many other things and the monetary incentive to watch the video clip would be gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The number of people that give the dollar back is not as high as we expected it was going to be. And I've actually, this is anecdotal, I don't have any numbers on this, but anecdotally, I would say that it seems to me that the number that give it back has gotten a lot lower as the program has gotten more professional. So I think when you've got like a hodgepodge booth together with some TV screens that don't match each other and some little cardboard privacy stations put around them and stuff like that, I think that you get more dollars back. I think when we've got a slick truck or these carts, because now we've got these kiosks, we've got a few of these kiosks. We've got three of them now that we also wheel around separately from the main tour. So we've got the truck and three kiosks, basically, and that do separate events from each other in separate parts of the country. And I think the more professional the outfit looks, the less likely people are to give back the dollar, which is a slight disappointment, but we're getting so many more viewers with the professional systems. And with the professional systems, we get to get pledges from them to move towards a vegan diet. So that's right on the touchscreen. The second the video ends, a screen pops up, says, you know, you can help stop this. You know, will you pledge to eat, you know, an animal-free diet 1 day a week, 2 days a week, And, you know, over 80% of the people that view pledge to go at least 1 to 2 days a week vegan. Uh-huh. And so we found that, you know, the slickness that gets us all these results is worth the slight loss in the in the dollar returns.
Well, it's not a loss. You know, there's always an expenditure for outreach, whether it's pamphlets or bringing in guest speakers for events.
Are you going to use the 10 Billion Lives to help with the Vegan Earth Day campaign?
They're fairly separate. So, yeah, we've been working for a couple decades now to try to do outreach to the environmental, you know, environmentally minded people about, you know, vegan diet and the way that animal agriculture is, you know, is terrible for climate change and other elements of the environment. We've been doing that for a couple decades, and we haven't, I mean, the 10 Billion Lives video is all about the animal cruelty. Mm-hmm. It's crossed our mind to make an environmental video that's 4 minutes and use it for the right instances. And I think we'd be open to it. Of course, it does cost money to make a new video. And if we're only going to use it a couple times a year versus every day of the year, like we use the cruelty video, it's maybe it's possible. It's not on the immediate plans, but it's definitely possible. And we do have kind of a full plate of new plans this year. So my guess is that probably wouldn't happen this year.
But well, what I was thinking is you could do it not only at Earth Day, but you could actually go to these meetings of these large environmental groups or conservation biology conferences and take that video to that kind of outreach venue. So try to hit more of the scientists and the other big green groups and see if you could reach them somehow, because there is a lot of resistance within the environmental movement to going vegan for some, like you said, some unknown reason.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I would be happy, honestly, with the environmental movement if they would just going vegan would be great, but more I would be happy if they just advocated a massive reduction. I would be okay with that. I for me, what annoys me is that when environmental groups do tackle the food issues, which they rarely do, they list like 10 things you can do. And maybe a vegetarian diet will be one of those 10 things, but no one's going to try a vegetarian or vegan diet when they're told that shifting to organic apples or, you know, or cage-free eggs or making sure that there's no plastic wrap around your, you know, whatever you buy. No, you know, when you make it sound like all these actions are equal, you know, going
good
vegetarian
point.
Or vegan is certainly going to be the one that's least interesting to people. And so what I would love is to work with the environmental movement to get a consensus that the number one food-related step that people should be taking is a drastic reduction of their meat consumption. That's what I would love the environmental movement to get behind. I mean, again, I would personally love even more if they would all, you know, all move towards a vegan diet. But I think as something that's reasonable that they could actually say, because they're not going to say go vegan. You're not going to get, you know, I don't think Greenpeace or Sierra Club in the next decade to be saying go vegan. But I
well,
do think it's
don't count that out. The Sierra Club right now is reviewing their ag policy. And I happen to know they're putting together a committee of people to work on the ag policy, and maybe you'd be interested in serving on that. I can put your name forward because, really, there is a lot of talk right now at the Sierra Club, at least, of trying to promote a more climate-healthy diet.
And a few years ago, the Sierra Club actually did prepare a paper about the impact of meat on the environment.
There's a small amount of movement there, so let me know if you're interested.
Yeah, I am, actually. I mean, that's definitely something that Farm has always been interested in, is trying to work with other movements to kind of progress our shared values and shared interests, basically.
Mm-hmm. How many employees do you have or members, volunteers, just in the Washington area? Because I'm wondering, you have such a large number of campaigns that you do.
Yeah, so our staff in the D.C. area is pretty small. It's just about 8 of us. We also, most of our campaign staffers, though, work on the West Coast. So we've got our director of outreach programs is in Portland, and he's the one that really directs the 10 Million Lives program. And he's got two other staffers who work with him in Portland. And then we've got the person that schedules all the 10 Million Lives tours, the national tour, as well as the kiosks. He's in around the San Jose, California area. And we've got a campaign staffer on our Live Vegan program in Chicago. We've got someone on our Live Vegan program in Hawaii. We've got someone on the Live Vegan program in Southern California. And so most of our campaign staffers are kind of spread all over. And then, of course, we also have the touring staffers, the people on the tours themselves.
Right.
And so, yeah, the Washington, D.C. office is mostly the kind of administrative and directors that, and our, you know, our office staff, things like, you know, those of us working on a lot more of the back end stuff, I guess. Most of the front end people kind of are spread across the country.
You have so many great campaigns. One of my favorites that I think has made a lot of difference in the country is Meatless Mondays. So many schools and companies have adopted this idea.
Yeah. I mean, we're not the only force behind that, but yeah, it's definitely something that I think we helped reinvigorate. I mean, I know that Meatless Mondays was it started in like the 40s, I think, related to World War II, and then it kind of took, you know, disappeared for a number of decades, and we wanted to bring it back. You know, we started out with just the email newsletter, the Meat Out Mondays newsletter. Really, for us, I think the idea was that we have the Meat Out campaign once a year to get people to try veganism for one day a year. And we said, you know, if they can do it one day, they can continue it one day a week at least. And then we noticed that the John Hopkins Institution was considering a similar program around the same time. And so between, you know, us and John Hopkins, and then I know that the Humane Society of the U.S. has also been getting on this. So between all the groups, I think that, yeah, I mean, also the Humane League is doing really good work right now in Philadelphia and a few other cities to get, you know, the city councils to pass the Meatless Mondays efforts. And we worked with some other groups in San Diego, California, to get their entire K-8 school district to adopt Meatless Mondays for all the public schools. So in San Diego, any kid K-8 has to eat vegetarian basically on Monday at school, which is pretty cool. Yeah, that effort really, I think, in the last year or two, kind of went from these little murmurs to just being something that really took off.
I think you should say gets the opportunity to eat vegetarian once a week rather than has to.
That's a really good point. I like that a lot. Yeah.
Even the U.S. Congress adopted Meatless Mondays for one day until the meat industry lobbied for them to quit doing that.
I know. It's funny because it was only an internal thing. Yeah, it wasn't even – they weren't even saying that the country needed to do it. It was literally just internal for themselves. And, God, yeah, the meat industry went ballistic on that. But that was good. You know, I mean, when they – you know, when they're that defensive, you're doing something right.
Exactly. So. It, you know, when you get backlash, it means you're doing something right.
What do you think about promoting just giving up meat one day a week and then people go and eat 4 cheeseburgers the next day? I mean – sometimes I wonder if just, I mean, it is getting people to start to think about their diet and what it means. I can see that as a good thing, but wonder if they get complacent and think, well, I did my part. I didn't eat any meat yesterday, so today I'll just have whatever I want. And then they continue, you know, eating a diet that's very harmful for themselves, the animals, and the planet.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. And so One thing that we take very seriously now in the last couple of years, especially since kind of getting this pledge program going with the 10 Billion Lives tour, is when it comes to the foot-in-the-door type activism, the idea of asking for a small ask in order to get a big ask later, right. One thing we've been realizing is that a lot of groups forget to make the bigger ask later. And if you forget to make the bigger ask, then I think you're absolutely right. You're going to stick with the small ask and not really make a big impact. I think the big key is to make those additional asks, and that's why everyone that we get to pledge with us, we also capture their email address, and we now have we have over 130,000 people that have pledged with us in the last couple of years to try a vegan diet at least one day a week. And so every one of them gets on our Meat Out Mondays email list where they receive a vegan recipe once a week. What we also do, and this was something that I was pretty proud of, but that was kind of clever of us, is we send an email for the first year every 3 months, so they get four emails, basically, separate from Meat Out Mondays. And this email is customized to their pledge, so it will say, you know, like, "Dear Beth, because of your commitment to eat vegan, you know, fill in the blank, 1 to 2 days a week or 3 to 4 days a week, you have now spared X number of animals from being raised and killed for food in the past 3 months, and this many acres of rainforest and this many gallons of water." And then we say, and this is, you know, congratulations, and if you move towards a fully vegan diet in the next 3 months, you'll spare this many animals and this many acres of rainforest and this many gallons of water. And so that's something that we've been trying, is kind of trying to use the small pledge to actually produce a bigger pledge.
And once you make someone commit to just one small change, it's much more likely that they'll commit to another change later.
If you make the second ask, and that's the key,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
That's what people forget sometimes, is they make the small ask and then never come back with the big ask.
Hmm.
And so we're trying to find ways to do both, to actually make the small ask and follow it with the big ask.
Right.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a tremendous amount of things going on. Michael, can you tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about all these exciting campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, our main website, which is about to be revamped completely but is still is up right now, is farmusa.org. So it's FARMUSA.org, the organization's farm animal rights movement. And we are actually about to launch basically a year-round fundraising campaign that is going to be, we've never had this before. The foundation that funds a lot of our 10 Billion Lives efforts is going to be offering a tripling campaign.
Wow.
So basically every dollar donated will be, they'll put in two. So essentially every dollar will be tripled in order to kick off some new plans we're going to do this year with the 10 Billion Lives program, which we'll be announcing on the website periodically. We'll be announcing kind of one project at a time, basically, for a while throughout this year. And so, yeah, a lot of good stuff happening this year, and you can learn all about it at farmusa.org.
You know, tripling your donation is making me want to send something right away.
Well, we won't complain if you do.
Okay. We've been talking with Michael Weberman, the executive director of the Farm Animal Rights Movement. We appreciate you being on the show, Michael, and continued success.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great chatting with both of you.
To learn more about a vegetarian or plant-based diet, you can visit the website of vsep.org. You can also join us for our winter dinner on February 22nd at Holiday Inn Sunland Park. Our featured guest is our own Greg Lawson, and he's going to give us his unique perspective on the state of the vegetarian movement.
And I'm not going to try and convince people to go vegetarian. I hope to make people smile and occasionally laugh at the absurdities of some of our dietary choices.
So if you want to hear more from Greg, reservations are due on February 18th, so visit vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you'll find them at ktep.org. Just click the Listen button for Animal Concerns of Texas. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.